Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with...
Andrea Subisati.
Oh, Andrea, you're so scary.
I'm such a big feet. I have the smallest feet.
You do. You're itty-bitty.
I have bought children's shoes.
I'm not
at a discount.
Shocked by that at all. I have to say, I was looking forward to this episode so much because the last few episodes have felt, you know, really heavy and really like you're taking a lot out of us in a really good way. But, you know, we try to manage our time the best we can. And I was like, oh, we're just going to do an episode about cryptids. It's going to be like super fun, a literal walk in the park. But Andrea, as you know from our G-chats daily, I have a lot of feelings about these films.
Yeah, it's a really weird subject. It appeals to a certain segment of society who take it to a certain place. And I think that's really interesting, but it's something that I've always been interested in kind of probing into. As editor of Rue Morgue, we had a columnist, a cryptozoology columnist, who had a one-page column every issue. You know, as you know, I don't have a whole lot of space. So if I'm devoting space to this subject, it's a very deliberate decision to be like, this is contributing to the horror world for some reason. And our resident cryptozoologist was by the name of Lyle Blackburn, who is a rock star. He's the lead singer of Ghoultown, which I actually knew him for before I came into contact with Rue Morgue and his cryptozoology. And yeah, I never quite got it. I knew that there was a tremendous following to this subject, and people were very passionate about it, and I never really understood why. And, you know, being me, I didn't want to disparage their fascination. I was fascinated by it and interested by it, so I'm really interested to get into it today with you.
Yeah, this isn't an area that I have a lot slash any expertise in, but it is something I was really familiar with, and the idea for this episode kind of came about from our Patreon. We were doing a vote on what our commentary should be on, and we picked the theme of found footage. So we wound up doing a commentary on Paranormal Activity.
Fun.
Which was super fun. I managed to scare the bejesus out of myself while we were doing it.
Yay.
But while Paranormal Activity was voted on as like the one we should do, really close second was Troll Hunter. So that kind of kicked us off on like, oh, we can do Troll Hunter. That would be fun. We haven't like talked about this film really. And then what could we pair it with? So then we came up with Willow Creek,
which has been on my list forever.
And it was a film I saw when it came out. So we're going to get into both of these films, but it really felt like, okay, cool, we can kind of take off the shackles of romantic relationships that we've been dealing with in the last few episodes and talk.
So.
We can go back to nature. We can literally go back to nature and talk about horror in a really elemental kind of way.
Yeah.
And I think both of these films, without us, you know, necessarily choosing them for this reason, I thought it was so interesting that they're both found footage horror films. Found footage horror, for those of you who don't know, is a huge passion of mine. I fucking love a found footage horror film. I just fucking love it. And in picking these, I hadn't really considered how they are both part of that genre, but also really disparate from each other. And so I think it's really cool that these films are kind of at odds with each other in the way they are portrayed and presented. So I'm really excited to talk about that. I'm excited to talk about, you know, mythological creepy figures, the minds that keep them alive today, and the shitty men we hope die.
Okay. Well, we're going to get into that. I feel like found footage lends itself so beautifully to this subject. I also love found footage, not just for its effectiveness in giving the creep factor, but I love the leveling mechanism of pick up a camcorder, give us your point of view on a subject, and scare the shit out of us. You know, the Blair Witch phenomenon made such tremendous waves within the horror genre in terms of what you can do with a teeny budget, with a great story, with a talented cast. You can give us the creeps just by being out in the woods with a camera and doing it right. And I feel like both these films utilize the medium to great effect.
I also think what's interesting about found footage horror is I certainly remember in the kind of, if you want to call it a heyday of found footage horror of the late aughts to the early 2010s, there was so much conjecture about why are they still filming? Why don't you just like drop the camera and fucking run?
Yes.
And now we have vloggers, now we have smartphones, and we are all so obsessed with capturing the moments of our lives that it now feels odd that you wouldn't capture something like this. So I'm excited to be revisiting these films, which came out, you know, 10-ish years ago with the eye of like, no, this is actually where we as a society have evolved to, of capturing these moments. This is how we would film it. This is how you would kind of generate a potential career. So I think time has actually been very kind to both these films.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also feel like the subject matter lends itself to found footage so, so well, because this is a subject that is all about proof. We have to prove this exists. We have to prove that I was there. And so, indeed, a lot of the foundational found footage stuff, such as the Patterson-Gimlin footage that we're going to talk about later, it is found footage. Cryptozoology is found footage, and these movies do it so, so well.
So let's take it to just a really basic definition before we get into both films. Cryptids are animals who have never been proven to exist. The ideas of them are based on claims and firsthand accounts, as Andrea just alluded to.
And cryptozoology is the study of these unconfirmed species, and it is both a pseudoscience and a subculture. It's a pseudoscience because the scientific method that we rely on really relies on objective proof of existence through observable phenomena. And the study of cryptids, it's interesting because it isn't so much about being able to prove that they exist, but being able to prove that we don't know that they don't. You know what I mean? There's supporting data, but the broad consensus, it's not enough for academia, but it's enough for a lot of people that we're going to talk about. And it's a subculture because there is this active, engaged community devoted to this stuff. There's books, there's movies, there's conventions and merch. And as we're going to talk about in Willow Creek, there's a whole tourism industry, and these are important facets to the conversation. Now, as for the appeal of cryptozoology, that's something that I have personally always kind of scratched my head about. It's not something that ever super interested me, and it's not that I don't super care if undocumented species are walking among us. I'd be content to let experts in the natural sciences investigate stuff like that rather than pack up a tent and camcorder and go see for myself. But I think that curiosity is really ingrained in people, and it's really, really interesting to study. How does anyone benefit from the existence of these creatures such that they're willing to risk their lives to prove it? And prove is in air quotes.
Yeah, those are heavy, heavy air quotes, my friends. And I think we both have a lot to say about that.
So to kick us off, I mean, we talk a lot about monsters on this show, which is to say supernatural figures of fiction that we load up with all of our fears and anxieties, things that are unnatural and unsettling. And I'm talking about vampires, werewolves, body snatchers, etc. Horror loves monsters that are sympathetic and misunderstood. And indeed, this podcast, you know, we really cut our teeth on unpacking all the attributes that we load up with these monsters and what they mean to us. And when it comes to Bigfoot specifically, I suspect that part of the appeal is that Bigfoot represents a missing link between humanity and primates. And that is such a tenuous line. It's such a culturally loaded line with like really far-reaching implications on an ideological level concerning our relationship between certainty and faith and the line therein. Like, faith is believing in something without evidence. And I think in 2021, we've become so incredibly polarized to the point where if you're a Christian, you're assumed to be a homophobic anti-vaxxer. And if you vote Republican, you're selling AK-47s at a KKK rally. And some of these stereotypes are grounded in reality, but they evoke really extreme reactions. And I think it's the same here. I think if you admit to believing in Bigfoot, you're entering a slippery slope where you're rejecting the scientific method and therefore anti-science and therefore a flat earther who believes that Elvis was a lizard person. And I think that warrants conversation.
He wasn't? What?
There are videos.
Thank God. Okay, good. Because I've seen those videos and they are convincing.
So this is a very big phenomenon. And when I was starting my research, I searched for both the movies that we're doing on Netflix and Amazon Prime, as I am wont to do. If we're going to do our homework, maybe I'm already subscribed and I can watch it for free. They weren't on there, but a bunch of Bigfoot docs came up that are a lot of found footage. I mean, not found footage, but, you know, homemade.
Amateur.
Amateur is the word I'm looking for.
Softcore.
Softcore. Perfect. Bigfoot Hunter goes through the woods, talks about the sounds, and finds footprints and maybe an overlarge turd. But I did learn something that threw me for a loop, and I found a doc called Discovering Bigfoot on Amazon Prime. Did you come across this?
I have not.
And this movie opened with the host explaining how he filed a civil lawsuit in BC Supreme Court in 2018. You haven't heard of this?
No.
So BC is British Columbia, if you don't know. It's the west coast of our fair country, and it is primo Bigfoot Sasquatch territory, from what I understand. And this dude's name is Todd Standing, and he also goes by the name Survivor Man Bigfoot.
Oh, he did come up. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And not only did he attempt to get the province to acknowledge that this creature exists and resides in BC, but he claimed that by refusing to acknowledge the existence of the creature, BC Fish and Wildlife infringed upon his fundamental rights by damaging his credibility as a crypto hunter. And I'll drop a link in the show notes, but the tremendous hubris and privilege that comes with such a claim, right? Like, this isn't just, Alex is making faces, so I know that she's with me. And this is where most people get really eye-rolly about cryptid enthusiasts, because there is a segment that veers dangerously close to conspiracy theories. And we discussed it at length in our Patreon episode on Godzilla versus Kong. Conspiracy theories and disinformation campaigns are incredibly dangerous these days. And so I really wanted to get that out on the onset that, like, when we are talking about these movies that came about before COVID, before the Trump era, conspiracy theories are different now, but they've always been around, and they've always been kind of used to validate the beliefs of people who erroneously believe themselves to be disenfranchised.
Yeah, I think for us in our generation, there is a sense that up until maybe 2016, 2015, conspiracy theories were relatively harmless. Mm-hmm. You know, sure, there are lizard people. Sure, Princess Diana was killed by the royal family. Who knows?
Your tin can hat isn't hurting anyone, so have at her.
And now it just feels so much more prevalent, and I feel like through watching both of these films, I felt a different weight to both of them.
Me too.
I don't think the filmmakers necessarily intended, but that's the beauty of being a filmmaker, is you are responding to something out there within the world and making these films. And the world doesn't stop when your film ends. Your film continues to exist within a discourse and a conversation.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought, like, this was going to be a lighthearted episode, and now I feel like it's actually quite heavy. in a post-Trump, post-Q, post-vax hesitant world.
It would have been different 5 years ago, that's
for
sure.
It absolutely would have. So I know I have a lot to say.
All right. Well, let's just get into it then. Troll Hunter came out in 2010, and here we go. Retrieved of a student project that aims to expose an illegal bear poacher working in the Norwegian wilderness. The students learn that the suspected poacher, Hans, is actually hunting and destroying trolls who have wandered out of their protected areas, a fact that is being covered up by a secret government organization, the TSS, aka the Troll Security Service. The students are skeptical at first, but become convinced after several outings with Hans expose them to a variety of woodland and mountain trolls. Hans allows the students to record his work because he's frustrated with the TSS. Not only is his work dangerous and underpaid, but the areas reserved for trolls to roam are shrinking, and he's not happy about having to destroy so many of these creatures. After dealing with a particularly troublesome mountain troll, the group is chased by TSS agents who want to confiscate their footage. An epilogue explains that the students were never heard from again and ends with a funny news clip where the Norwegian Prime Minister casually admits to the existence of trolls while the TSS agent mentioned, squirms uncomfortably. I mean, you've all seen the movie, presumably, if you've done your homework, but this is a funny film. It's funny, it's tongue-in-cheek, it's satire, it's really fun.
This film is epic in the way that almost no other found footage horror film is. When we think of found footage horror films, it's usually like, oh, they're kind of like done on the cheap and they're really creepy because they're so intimate. Mm-hmm. Whereas Troll Hunter, it involves multiple layers of characters, multiple locations, it involves mythology, it involves history, it involves so many different things that it actually feels like this film kind of blew up what we thought found footage horror could be.
Yeah.
And I think what its kind of main intent was, while I don't think Troll Hunter had the biggest budget in the world, it certainly was very expansive in what it did.
Yeah.
And when we were, you know, consuming, and as we do, North American found footage horror, it was all very, like, intimate and seedy and, you know, designed to take place in very small, localized locations, mm-hmm. whereas this feels so expansive and so huge.
These huge mountains, these huge, tremendous, beautiful vistas. And indeed, found footage is supposed to be real. The verite aspect is where, you know, found footage hangs its hat. And so the fact that this found footage is cut with these CGI creatures who, they look great.
Yeah.
They looked amazing when this film first came out and I first saw it and I was like, holy shit. But the fact that these films are doctored in that way to show us these impossible beings within this guise of this is reality, this is true, I think is so cryptozoological.
And I think that's part of it is you're ingratiated into this world through the medium of the content, and the content and the frame of this film is found footage. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you have this huge, you know, bigger than life CGI creature stalking towards you.
Yeah.
And it's interesting as an audience member to have to reconcile that.
Yeah.
Between I'm used to this very intimate found footage and, oh, wow, there's a huge, like, fantastical creature marching towards me and then chasing me.
Yeah, it's a different level of suspension of disbelief, but I went along with it. Like, I feel like the first time you see a troll, and indeed, this film is imbued with humor. I want to talk about the use of humor in this film that kind of, it's very disarming.
Yes.
And it kind of allows the film to get away with a lot that a lot of found footage couldn't get away with. I don't expect all the verite. As soon as I see that first creature, I'm like, oh, this is for fun. And I think that's kind of an inside joke that Norwegian audiences were in on from the very beginning. And that is a function of the casting. Otto Jespersen, the lead, and Hans Morten Hansen are well-known comedians in Norway. So Norwegian audiences would have been like, oh, this is for fun. This is for laughs. So the role of Thomas is played by Hans Morten Hansen, who is a well-known comedian in Norway. He actually holds a record for the longest stand-up performance at 38 hours,
what?
14 minutes. I have yet to look up that footage, but I sure as shit will. So I think Norwegian audiences were in on the joke a little bit earlier, whereas when this film debuted, it was a midnight screening, from what I understand, and a lot of audiences went in blind. Audiences internationally enjoyed the film, but it might have been received a little bit differently.
Yeah, and I think it's important to kind of recognize the role that trolls play within our society. Trolls do come from a very rich Norse mythology, and a lot of what they say in the film is deeply indebted to that. There are different kinds of trolls. There are ones that occupy mountains and forests and then caves. But almost always trolls are at odds with humans. And it's always kind of an adversarial kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And rocks tend to be used to signify where trolls were because, as the film depicts and indeed says in a few occasions, that, you know, when trolls are exposed to UV sunlight, they turn into stone. So when you see a large scattering of stones and rocks, you can kind of say, like, oh, that's where a troll was at some point.
Yeah, they also eat them, right?
Yeah. There's a whole, like, there's a lot of deep, very rich mythology about trolls. And then I think very much for our kind of Western audiences, there's everything from the Three Billy Goats Gruff, which, again, originated from Scandinavia, that story. But then you also have a lot more kind of people to the West taking up this mythology with Tolkien in Lord of the Rings. And then there's also children's films like, I don't know if you remember this from our childhood, but Troll in Central Park.
No.
It was like a Don Bluth film. And that came up in my YouTube, like, searches, and wow, that sent me back.
It's a film for children?
Yes, it is. It's about a very friendly troll in Central Park. That's about it.
Oh.
There are also trolls in the film Frozen, the one with the women and the singing and the...
Let It Go.
Let It Go. Let It Go. But then, of course, there are troll dolls. Did you have a troll doll?
Yup. I had a handful.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Right. I remember I used to keep them in a shoebox, and you would just look at the shoebox, and you'd just be able to see all the tops of their heads.
The crazy
hair,
yeah.
The poofs, and they had the little pot belly, and after a while, like, the gemstone in their navel.
Yes. Yeah.
It was a trend.
It was a total trend, and now there are troll movies, like CGI movies. In fact, when the pandemic first started, the troll movie, I think it was called, like, World Tour, was one of the first kids' movies to be on VOD from theaters.
Yeah.
So that did, like, crazy box office, simply because it was on VOD at the beginning of the pandemic.
Right.
And then, of course, RPG games.
Yes.
So, yes, these creatures have a total real mythology that is devoted to a certain culture and place, but they also have a really larger kind of contextual meaning to all of us, I think. And also, there are people who believe that, to some degree, trolls were real, that they were kind of Neanderthal tribes that existed on the outskirts of, in this case, Norway or Scandinavia at large, across all those countries. And they existed, and then as, you know, certain societies and parts of society continue to progress, they were kind of deemed these outsiders and placed in this really specific cone of mythology that they were trolls and things like that.
Mm.
And then, of course, I think we all have that immediate response to the word troll of internet troll.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually didn't put it together. Oh, I wonder how that started.
Well, because I think trolls, from their very meaning from Norse mythology, were always kind of meant to fuck with us. You know,
you fuck with them first, though, right? Like, don't disturb the troll.
Don't cross that bridge.
Exactly.
Don't go into their territory.
Yeah,
don't
leave them alone and they'll leave you alone and they'll be fine.
Don't
and if
feed
only
them.
That were fucking true of internet trolls. Like, that's something I've come up against again and again. And I think you have too, where, like, we've encountered harassers online and it's like, oh, just don't feed the trolls. It's like, well, I'm doing my work and I'm minding my own fucking business. How is that feeding anyone's ire?
Yeah.
But they will find you.
Well, you know, Andrea, bridges are metaphorical. And as trying to make arguments and reach people and do things is considered crossing a boundary. And some people take real fucking offense to that. But let them. One thing I find really interesting about this film is the nature of bureaucracy.
Yes.
Within it. It's fascinating because it comes to the forefront really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
In large part, to me, Troll Hunter is a film about bureaucracy and government myths and how countries ignore, reject, or are just plain evil about their own believed histories.
Yeah.
And that Troll Hunter is kind of about a collective myth rather than an individualized experience or conspiracy theory. And that's why I think this film kind of has a little bit of its cake and eats it too, which I think is a good thing because it does, I think, a lot of good in the long run. So I'm going to mention a book throughout both of the films we talk about today. And it's by Colin Dickey, and it's called The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. We'll link it in the show notes. It is a fantastic book. Highly recommend it if you are interested in the subject. It's truly phenomenal. So Dickey really does deep dives into all of these kind of spaces and theories. And a lot of his takeaways are about, as our world and our cultures progress, there were less unknowns in the world through colonial expansion and through science, and that through that, there was much less wonder in the world, and that the importance of scientific mistakes became hugely important because through a scientific mistake, there was a door opened for an alternate theory proposing that there is something else that was going on that was being kept from the general public.
So the mistake would be just the omission of the existence of trolls.
Well, in this case, it's really interesting because within the film, there is those, you know, spats about that's the wrong kind of bear to leave here.
Ah.
Oh, and when they leave the bear prints and they're kind of like, they mix up the feet.
Hilarious.
It's hilarious. But those are the things that conspiracy watchers would go like, that bear doesn't go here and those feet are interned. And what is happening here? The same way that, you know, if you look at the vaccination campaigns that are going on worldwide and people are saying like, oh my God, there are blood clots and we have to pause everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, there are blood clots and we have to be aware of them. But also if you're taking the birth control pill,
blood clots are a thing.
Far more likely if you're taking the birth control pill. And again, I'm all for scientific, you know, being safe and being wary and all of that stuff. But
yeah,
all of those little, like, little loopholes that people will find, there is a sense of like, well, something else is going on.
Uh-huh.
What is that thing? And as humans, our instinct is to fill that space with meaning. So for me, what Troll Hunter does is it takes these spaces where people, and we'll talk about this a bit more in the next film, become very individualized and very self-serving, and it actually tries to imbue it with a larger, more important message.
Mm.
And I don't know if you picked up on this, but I definitely thought a lot about the demodernization of the characters throughout the film.
Tell me more.
So as the characters kind of move through the film, they become less modern. It starts with the filmmakers, again, these student filmmakers meeting up with Hans, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, if you're going to come with me, strip off your clothes, go bathe in the lake, cover yourself with this shit. They're foregoing hygiene.
I love that part.
It's an eschewing of everything we know to be like, here is my sweet thing that I bought at Mountain Equipment Co-op.
Yeah.
It's, you know, here's my fucking camper van. Here's all of this. It's like, no, you have to go wash in the lake and you have to cover yourself with this shit. Also, I thought the scene where Hans has to go battle the troll literally under the bridge with the three goats on top of it. And when he comes out in that getup, it's very knight-like.
Yeah.
K-N-I-G-H-T. It just immediately evoked a kind of medieval figure going to approach this lost monster that we have all kind of forgotten about. Then the camera person Kaylee's confession about being a Christian.
Yeah.
Again, speaking very generally right here. It's not everyone that comes forward and says, I'm a Christian. I believe in religion these days. Sometimes it's a bit more subtle. And so to be faced with your maker to a certain degree and be like, oh, God, no, I believe in it. And did that be your downfall is kind of intense.
Yeah, I thought that part was so interesting because I think for someone who identifies as agnostic, who is open-minded and is just like, I don't know, maybe I'm a Christian. I'm not closed off to it. And I feel like that was the case with Kali, was that when you're confronted with the reality of something like trolls, it opens all the avenues. It opens the floodgates to, well, maybe I am a Christian because holy fuck, if these things exist, maybe so does God.
Yeah, exactly. And even Tomas, when he gets that bite very early on in the film, and he kind of feels weird throughout the film, and then it's like, oh, that troll has rabies. You probably have rabies. Again, it's something that we now have shots for, but we now, you know, in the state with trolls, we don't kind of know how to deal with. Again, it's a kind of regression to a certain degree, but a demodernization of everything these characters knew, of everything they were prepared for. So for Dick, the genealogy of these beliefs stem from 19th century science, when science and religion became two separate forces, and there was a general kind of disenchantment with the world. Science and religion were now opposing forces. People had to be trained and be professional in order to claim and articulate scientific discoveries. You couldn't just go out into the woods and be like, there's a fucking troll. It was like, no. You have to be certified to a certain degree. And so for Dickey, this is where he kind of posits that pseudoscience brings science and mysticism back together. And he references a theorist by the name of Svetlana Boehm, who coins the term off-modern. And she talks about how we kind of have now in our history, we're not looking straight ahead, but we are examining all the dangling threads in our society. It's like we aren't moving all together towards the next thing of like, let's cure cancer, let's cure COVID, let's cure all these coronaviruses. It's like, okay, let's do that. But also, let me go on this little troll hunt. Let me go do this. Let me see what that's about. And it's a really interesting thing because we have so much at our fingertips now because we have expanded beyond, I think, what many of us thought was possible. And now we want to see more. And as we individualize continually, we want to have claim and stake to certain parts of this world.
Yes.
And it is a really, cryptozoology and troll hunting and all of this stuff is a really powerful way to do that.
Yeah.
There's instant notoriety that if you can say, here's a fucking troll under a bridge, you get stuff.
Not only have I proved the existence of trolls, but I have discredited science. I have overthrown the scientific method. Mm-hmm. I have overthrown the ivory tower of the academics who control the scientific method.
Absolutely.
So that sense of, I don't know if I want to call it egotism, but there is definitely, you want to be the one to do it. And I get that sense from all the Bigfoot documentaries out there that they're not just like, I'm presenting this for the sake of science, and I'm presenting it for the sake of themselves. There is an article called Cryptozoology in the Medieval and Modern Worlds by Peter Dendel that I will link to in the show notes. Peter Dendel, who is an English prof who specializes in folklore, and he identified three functions of cryptozoology to help explain its appeal, which to me was ground zero for this episode. It's just like, why do people care and why do I not care? And he kind of came up with three reasons. One is that it channels our guilt over what we're doing to the environment, trying to reestablish a link to the environment. And I was kind of critical about that because it seems to me that leaving these creatures in peace is the more humanitarian, environmentally friendly thing to do. So I don't fully buy that cryptozoologists are in it for the benefit of the environment. The second reason is that it recaptures a sense of mysticism and danger in a world now perceived as fully charted and overexplored. And this is the one that kind of broke my brain over the past couple of weeks because we're talking about an effort to prove the existence of these creatures, which would then solve the mystery and remove that appeal. You know, so if you're in it for the mystery, why are you trying so hard to eliminate that mystery? People like Todd Standing that I mentioned before aren't content to marvel at the mystery of the universe. He wants to solve it, and not only solve it, but get credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm critical of that one. And then the third thing that Dendel mentions is, quote, an implicit ground of conflict and dialogue between untutored masses and educated elite. And that was the one that I found the most interesting because Dendel notes that there's a disconnect between academia and popular culture and that this came about in the post-Enlightenment world. And he goes on about what a fucking buzzkill science can be in this context. Like, better understanding of health means that medical authorities are taking all our fun away, our full sugar Coca-Cola, our cigarettes, suntanning, etc. And they were right to warn us about things, of course, but it's normal that some of us would be like, fuck you, ivory tower, you don't know everything and I have to live my life. And to a certain extent, that discourse has entered the COVID reality that we're still grappling with now. And I think it's a really valid interpretation of the conspiracy theories that have flourished over the past few years because, you know, now science is telling us that there's this and we need to stay in and stay home and people are willing to believe literally everything other than that.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can go about their daily lives. And I just think that's such an interesting thing that Troll Hunter kind of probes. It's that, do you want to live in ignorance of this or do you want to actually care about what matters in the world?
Absolutely. And to me, the most affecting part of this film is throughout the film, Thomas is saying like, oh, Hans, you're like a hero. You are.
Yeah.
You know, people don't know you should be a hero. So kind of using the student documentary to be like, oh, we're going to shine this light on this incredible person. And then Hans's confession, mm-hmm. where he talks about in the 70s when they were building kind of railways through the mountains. And he was tasked with killing trolls because they wanted to build through their territory.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to kill women and he had to kill children. And in the midst of this funny fantasy film, it fucking knocked me on my ass.
It chills you to the bone.
Because certainly in Canada, in North America, we live in a colonized society. We are settlers on a land that is not ours. And, you know, I think about it more and more as I've become aware of everything my ancestors have done And in the midst of this fun fantasy horror adventure, it knocked me down in a really important way that I think films like this should do. And of course, the director of this film, Andre Ovedal, who did Autopsy of Jane Doe, which we've also done on a past episode. He's also done Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. He's a very kind of conscious filmmaker in my mind. He's very aware of what he is saying and how he's saying it, which I really appreciate about him. And this film is, you know, it's not beating you over the head with this, but if you are an audience member, I think with a heart and a soul, this moment is going to stick with you.
Mm-hmm. I believe in trolls because it's fun. I believe in Bigfoot because it's fun. Well, maybe the reasons that these creatures aren't around are not fun. I think it's really chilling, and it takes something folkloric and magical and mystical, and it brings it to the real world with such a crash that it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. My only kind of previous knowledge of Norway, where this film is set, comes from my theater degrees. And I'm, you know, very grateful. I seem to be getting a lot of mileage out of my degrees the last few episodes. But I spent a lot of time in my undergraduate and especially my graduate year studying Henrik Ibsen, who is probably one of, if not the foremost playwright out of Norway. And he was certainly one of the foremost playwrights out of the 19th century for plays like Peer Gynt, A Doll's House, and in this case, a play called Ghosts. And it's not a play about ghosts, as in the, ooh, I know.
What other ghosts are there?
There's like the emotional ghosts of past traumas and things like that. However, one of the things I came to study a lot of with Ibsen was the use of light in Norwegian plays.
Okay.
So basically in the winter months, there's not a whole lot.
No.
It's real dark all the time. And there's a lot of, like, for us in North America, you feel seasonal depression. It's amplified, like, 10 times that when you kind of get up that far north. Mm-hmm. So his play Ghosts has to do with a lot of really likable and really fucking tragic figures. And ultimately, I'm going to spoil a play that was written over 100 years ago, so I'm sorry, skip ahead if you must.
Fine.
But ultimately, it ends with an adult son asking his mother to kill him with an overdose of morphine.
Oh.
He has inherited syphilis from his ne'er-do-well father, and he is succumbing to syphilis, and he asks his mother to make his last moments bearable. And a whole bunch of shit has happened throughout the play, and everything is awful and terrible that started out good and well-intentioned. And the final moments of this play is this incredibly complex female character holding doses of morphine in her hand as the sun rises into the room and it illuminates everything within it. And you have this son character who is, you know, begging for death as he succumbs to this horrible illness that he inherited, and a mother not knowing what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it is utterly tragic, utterly fucking heartbreaking. And it's very reminiscent to the shit I talked about in the Wreck episode, whereas we cast light on the things that we don't fucking want to talk about. And that is our power as artists. And that's what Ibsen was doing. That is what the filmmakers of Wreck are doing. That is what Troll Hunter is doing, is they are saying all of these things we talk about on the fringes and the things we don't want to bring to light, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, means that Troll Hunter is a film about colonialism. It is a film about not even segregation, it is about eliminating a certain species for the benefit of another.
Mm-hmm.
It is about looking down on other things that are not us.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so harmful. And I think this film, throughout a lot of fun, a lot of inventiveness, a lot of fantasy, does a lot of good through being like, you know what? This actually isn't all fun and games. Again, this is up to us as an audience. If we take that beat when Hans is like, I'm not a hero, here's my monologue about it, and take it on board, then it's a really powerful film. And I think, you know, to me, it kind of goes into the form informing the content. sense. So this is like a kind of pseudo student film. They're trying for authenticity. They're trying to capture what's impossible in order for it to be provable. So that there is a kind of spiritual similarity with the Blair Witch Project.
Mm-hmm. Students are only after the truth. Like, they have no political ulterior motives.
They're excited to be, like, onto something.
Yeah.
Because in academia, that's all you have.
That's it.
If you get to break something, holy shit. And this is not only breaking, oh, my God, there are trolls. It's, oh, my God, it's a whole government cover-up.
Yeah.
It is huge. And I think this film is really utilizing that kind of mythology around government hiding something really important. It's not necessarily in, I think as I was mentioning before, an individual mythology of like, I'm going to go prove Bigfoot is real. Spoiler alert, stay tuned to the next film that we're going to talk about. It is about, let's expose what the government has fucking done.
Uh-huh.
And it is about a collective mythology about, well, we were always here and we've just always been here and it's all fucking great and don't fucking worry about it. And then this man going, I had to kill women and children for like a railway.
I had to commit genocide.
Yeah.
So that you can all live your lives nicely.
And again, to go back to Ibsen, it's the sunlight streaming through the end of Ghosts, and it's the sunlight hitting those trolls, that it was like, sunlight is a rarity. It's fucking gold in that North Hemisphere, that part of it. And it's showing us what we have to do. And I think throughout the film, what it does is it really begins to humanize these figures, which are monstrous and weird, but it's like, no, they're personalities and they come from different places. And these ones are acting up because they have rabies. And
yeah, the way they throw that in toward the end is it just explains their hostility and it really engenders a sympathy.
Exactly, because they can't figure out why they've ventured so far away from their home territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, for me, I think trolls in this film are representative of what humanity has evolved from. They're meant to be these kind of like primordial things that we have seemingly become better than. However, they are still us.
Mm-hmm.
We just figured out a way to beat them.
Mm-hmm.
And we are unable to reconcile ourselves and who we believe ourselves to be with the cost of life that came for our reason of being.
Yeah, yeah.
And so while it's a really funny, strange, wonderful film, to me it just felt really fucking tragic.
Yeah.
In a way it didn't when I first watched it.
Yeah, it definitely has a very dark undercurrent because all those threads come together right in the end when it's just like, trolls are fine as long as you don't venture into their territory. Well, too late. We have not only ventured into their territory, we have colonized it. We have trampled it. We have backed them into a corner and given them a disease, and now we have to dispatch them. It's a very ugly reality to come crashing down at the end of such a lighthearted, tongue-in-cheek film.
But that's, I think, what great filmmaking is. It's a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to talk so much more about colonialism and how it has impacted all of our histories and who we are. And it is something that so many people in charge of things are not willing to talk about and not willing to cede authority and representation towards.
Yeah.
And that is super fucking problematic.
Yeah, that we should just dispatch rather than engage and cover it all up. It's ugly, and it's ugly to see conspiracy theories warped and twisted into what they are today, you know. Again, going back to our current climate, you know, conspiracy theories to hide harm and conspiracy theories that can cause harm. I think, again, it's just like we were saying, how you watch this film differently today than you would 5 years ago.
Yeah. So with that sobering note in mind, we are going to jump in to the 2013 film Willow Creek.
Check one. My boyfriend's a big idiot. Check one. I said I would come on this trip to help you with your film, and it's your birthday, and we're gonna have a great time, but I'm not about to say that I believe in Bigfoot.
Well, then why are you here?
I like being with you.
I just don't want you to think I'm crazy.
Pets and people go missing all the time.
I'll go in there myself. You can just stay here in town if you want.
You believe any nut job out there that says Sasquatch is real?
Your friends will all think you're crazy, and you'll spend all of your days searching for something that you never find.
I never felt this way about anyone.
It's about 29 miles north of here. You come to the bottom of Bluff Creek.
We're here.
We're here.
When you get in there, it's a steep canyon, there's a running creek, there's forest, it's thick. and you're going to feel how isolated they were.
Callie, come here.
The real truth of it is you're out in the middle of nowhere.
How do we know we're going in the right direction?
You don't want to be in the movie, and now you're Stanley fucking Kubrick.
Turn off the camera.
There's a lot of people live back in these woods, and they just don't like other people in their business.
Turn that fucking thing
off.
Okay,
let's go, Jim.
See the buckshot on the sign?
What is my sock doing in the tree?
People didn't want us to come out here, so people are probably fucking with us. Just go back to bed. Did you hear that?
Hear what? That sounds like someone's crying.
Is accompanying her boyfriend Jim on a camping trip to Willow Creek so he can investigate Bigfoot for himself. A staunch believer that Bigfoot is real, Jim has chosen Willow Creek as it's the site of the Patterson-Gimlin film, the most famous footage of Bigfoot ever. Kelly and Jim stop in at the town where they play filmmaker, interviewing locals and learning more about the mythical creature. They ignore warnings not to go into the woods and proceed to set up camp. After returning to the campsite from a swim, they find it trashed by unseen forces. That night, after Jim's failed proposal to Kelly, but her agreeing to move in with him, they are tormented by strange noises, culminating in an attack on the tent. The next day, they agree to go back to the car and leave, but they go in circles. That night, still in the forest, they hear the same noises from the night before. They encounter a naked woman whose face they saw on missing persons posters in the town. The noises from the night before return once again. Jim is brutally killed off screen. Kelly screams, and the strange noises are heard yet again.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the film. Like, in addition to owing a lot of its narrative DNA with the Blair Witch Project, it picks up a lot of cues from that film, but also kind of does its own thing with it.
Absolutely. And I first saw this film at Toronto After Dark when it premiered in 2013. And from what I can recall from all the way back then.
It's almost 10 years ago.
Almost 10 years. I seem to remember the director / script outliner Bobcat Goldthwait being in attendance and speaking a bit after the film. Now, he was definitely a figure I remember from my childhood. Being
big
around,
comedian in the 90s.
Huge stand-up comedian, Police Academy films. I remember him most from the film Scrooged.
I was going to mention Scrooged. Yeah. He has this persona, this particular lilt of his voice.
He's got this crazy voice.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's okay.
And he's made several films. This was his first horror film. I believe it was his sixth feature film, but he's also known for these really controversial appearances on late night TV spots where he'd act really erratically, sometimes violently. He famously lit Jay Leno's guest chair on fire and is a convicted arsonist as a result. So he's a character. And when I found out that this particular guy made a horror film and it's actually pretty good. I mean, preparing for this episode was my first time watching the film and I couldn't divorce my brain from Bobcat Goldthwait made this.
Well, and I, from what I remember, again, is really pulling from vague, perhaps supplanted memories in my head, he just came out and like spoke a bit as a normal person without his like crazy voice at the end of it and answered some questions and, you know, that was it. But he definitely has such a very specific place in my childhood, and it's really interesting to me that he made this film. And I think that it's a very unintentionally political film. And I was a bit nervous because when we were putting this episode together, I kind of said, well, the Troll Hunter thing we'd agreed upon, and then we were looking for another film to pair with it. And I was like, oh, Willow Creek. I remember seeing it like 7 years ago and really liking it.
Yeah, it's another found footage film concerning a Bigfoot search.
But again, it's 7 years ago, and what the fuck did I know 7 years ago? So I was generally pleased rewatching it, how much it held up.
Okay.
I will say I remember seeing it in a PAX cinema at Scotiabank Theatre in downtown Toronto for Toronto After Dark, and that long 18-minute sequence from the proposal to the noises to everything else, it was truly chilling.
Uh-huh.
It was such a, like, fucking in-the-theater moment to feel that. And I think it's, you know, that kind of moment of the film that possibly plays a little bit better in a cinema, but it still really held up watching it. So
yeah, I was very nervous. You know, it's a very, very long shot of the two of them in their tent, and there's a little window off to the side, and I remember looking from them to the window, to them to the window, and just waiting for something mm-hmm. to happen and being on fucking tenterhooks, very Blair Witch-esque, very suspenseful.
Yeah, and I think it's a real testament to the restraint of this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to give you a lot up front, and it's going to hold so much back from you at the end.
Uh-huh. Now, I feel like this film tackles an aspect of Bigfoot and cryptozoology that the prior film didn't, which is to say the tourism aspect of it. I mentioned earlier mm-hmm. that cryptozoology is a subculture, and we really see that in this film, is that he's at Harrison Hot Springs in BC, the Sasquatch capital of the world. The gift shop is a Sasquatch museum, and on the one hand, there's an element of the population that's like, yeah, come try your luck at finding Sasquatch, eat a Sasquatch burger, buy something at the gift shop. But the locals are very hostile to the idea of actually finding Sasquatch. Like, leave here. It's dangerous. It's turn around and come back from whence you came. There's definitely an aspect of you don't belong here and outsiders are not welcome.
Well, and it's so prevalent within this film because, I mean, the kind of harbinger of doom I always think of is, you know, Crazy Ralph in the Friday the 13th films, but in this one, you've actually got a guy who's like at the entrance to where they're going to drive down to the campground going, no,
yeah.
Don't come in here.
Turn around or I'll kick your fucking ass. And he appears to mean it. He's like, in contrast to, you know, the gas station guy in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, who was like, go at your own risk. This guy's like, get the fuck out of here. And he's throwing stones and he's very hostile. And so the decision to persist is a lot stronger.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think we should maybe just take a quick look at what the Bigfoot slash Sasquatch phenomenon is.
I would love to, because I get the sense that preparing for this episode was the first time you watched that fucking Patterson-Gimlin footage. Is that the case?
Yes, but as soon as I saw it, I was like, I've seen the still.
Sure, yeah. I remember Paul Korup did a Bigfoot presentation at Festival of Fear. It seems like 1,000 years ago. And again, like I said, we would tackle this topic so much differently now, but he was talking about Bigfoot. He showed the footage and it sucked.
Oh, to me, when I finally saw it, because it's only ever referenced in the film, they don't ever, you know,
repeatedly repeat as if it's gospel.
Yeah. And I, you know, found it on YouTube and I watched it and I was like, that looks like if I put Andrea in a monkey suit and told her to walk funny.
Yeah.
And you just kind of walked across a marsh.
And that's no slag on me, but like an untrained actor, just fucking walk and turn your head. Like,
it just makes me think we just haven't, you know, found our full-on revenue stream yet.
Oh, okay. Well, you know? It's not too late. I'm still a size 5.
Maybe a harpy of Lake Ontario.
The Lake Ontario harpy. She's got that shining tattoo. That's how you'll know her.
Just vaping in a corner. Hisses at you when you come too close. But Bigfoot and Sasquatch tend to be, you know, the same name for the same thing. From what I could discern, Sasquatch is more commonly used in Canada, whereas Bigfoot is more common in the States.
Okay.
It is, you know, a large human ape-like creature. And as we alluded to earlier in this episode, it has a lot of links to our cultural mythology, to our kind of missing link obsession that we have as humans. And it was really in 1958 that this name Bigfoot came about, when a logging company who was digging out nearby Willow Creek, where the film takes place, began to see unusually large footprints and even a strange creature appearing in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, commonalities of some of the Bigfoot sightings, and I use commonality as a very loose term, but some of the traits of Bigfoot's, big feats, shall we say, are repetitive knocking sounds, howls, moans. There's believed to be some kind of language between them.
Mm-hmm.
They can maybe kill deer, they can kill dogs, but they might also have a plant-based diet. And that's just even the bit I gleaned from Wikipedia. So there's already a lot of contradictory information happening here. But Bigfoot, I think, kind of exists within our own Western mythology as something we have imagined. And there are, you know, kids' movies about Bigfoot. There's, you know, fun video games about Bigfoot and Sasquatch. There's all kinds of things that this creature has gone from, you know, it's a completely unlicensed character. And so it's just kind of evolved into something we hold near and dear to us. I mean, if we talk about the troll dolls and Troll Hunter, then we can talk about Harry and the Hendersons in this part of the episode. But the Patterson-Gimlin film was shot in 1967 in Northern California, right by Willow Creek. And as we mentioned, it's real grainy. You will find people on the internet defending this video like it is their blood relative.
Totally. This video is like, for all its graininess, and it's been stabilized, it's been enhanced and enhanced and enhanced as if it is incontrovertible proof. Which it is anything but.
And that's the thing, is like, there is part of me as like a horror fan and a fan of general creepy things where I'm like, I'm willing to engage with this as a kind of like distant thing. But I think what concerns me more is some people deal with it as if it's real.
They glom onto it and it becomes, like gospel truth. I think, you know, that allegory is like people who interpret the gospel as literal truth. It's like, well, no, there's some symbolism there. There's some allegory. There's some interpretation. We don't have to take these things as literally as we do.
No, and this is the thing, is like we can, as humans, you know, we talk about this so much on the podcast, we can watch something, we can take something in, but it doesn't mean that it's the be-all and end-all. Mm-hmm. It exists within our wealth of knowledge. It exists within the things we previously know, the things we're going to learn, and we assimilate it into this knowledge that we procure for ourselves. And this is where I kind of want to go back to the Unidentified book by Colin Dickey, and he has a series of chapters about Bigfoot and the Bigfoot phenomena that are absolutely fascinating. So I'm going to run us through a few things right now. So through Dickey's lens, the birth of cryptids is really tied to the end of the known world. The further we venture into territories known and unknown, the increase in sightings of Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Jersey Devils, what have you.
Chupacabras.
Without these kind of borders between humans and the unknown, we begin to infringe upon them and we begin to project onto them. Mm-hmm. We are aided in this by colonialism, by capitalism, by trade, and as Andrea just mentioned, tourism. As I already mentioned, with logging and suburban expansion, we increasingly move into their territories. The myths and legends perpetuate themselves. It is a dichotomy of species close to us, but still habitating in nature. So Bigfoot could be the missing link, but we are so infused in our suburban lifestyle or in our home lifestyle. But here are these things that could be potentially really close to us, but they're okay in nature. And in fact, they often want to be left alone in nature. So for Dickey, what's kind of interesting about all this is in the search for them, it's often a very solitary search. You don't often go in with big groups because it doesn't seemingly make sense. You have to go in on your own or with one or two people.
You need to be quiet.
You need to be quiet. And in doing so, you kind of solidify yourself once again in nature. You have to go back. You have to kind of reject, again, that kind of demodernizing that I talked about in Troll Hunter. You kind of have to go back to that. You've got to leave the car behind. You got to hope your tent works.
Your cell phone doesn't work out here.
Doesn't fucking work. So you gotta go back to nature. Mm-hmm. Now, as Dickey points out, Bigfoot legends, as I already mentioned, emerged out of the 1950s culture from white loggers. Now, he really ties this to a post-World War II masculinity crisis.
Uh-huh.
There was an economic boom after World War II, but a lack of roles for what was perceived to be a quote-unquote traditional male role. It was not someone who could work with their hands anymore, but it was someone more geared towards a desk job. To quote Dickey, a masculine malaise helped push the popularity of men's adventure magazines. This provided a rich fantasy for those from a generation that still valued a masculinity built on hard labor and living off the land. Before the Willow Creek incident, John Byrne of the Chelyas Indian Reservation was collecting Sasquatch stories for publishing and actually put them out in 1929. And then they were kind of forgotten about and often dismissed as a hoax. However, these stories were revived with white loggers as yet another example of appropriation of mythologies and culture by white people. Mm-hmm. And it became a way, again, to quote Dickey, for the white people to romanticize what they were about to destroy. Mm. So in these chapters, Dickey actually speaks to one Clyde Tallio, who is a Newhawk storyteller. He says that to pull out an individual creature such as Bigfoot or Sasquatch, essentially the same thing, is to completely actually misunderstand the mythology of the indigenous people and of the land around them, because none of these things exist as individuals. They exist as part of an ecosystem, as part of a community. So to pull something out and kind of reify it is, again, a kind of lame attempt at individualism. Mm. Again, missing the point of all of these things have to cohabitate, right, and we have to respect it, and we have to live with it, and we have to understand it. And it is not this one thing against us or this one thing for us to discover. It is a much bigger thing. Mm-hmm. So I actually took a lot of that in this small moment in Willow Creek to be quite interesting. When Jim interviews Sean of the Hoopa tribe, it's one of the interviews they do at the beginning of the film, and he talks to her, and she, you know, she's part of the reservation and part of the tribe, and she goes on a Christian camping trip, which is already a kind of loaded statement, mm-hmm, which I actually tried to research and wasn't able to unpack. But she and her father in a car encounter something that seems to be Bigfoot-esque, and they're scared of it, and they let it walk away.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that seems to me so much of what the indigenous culture is. It's, we exist in this land. There are other things around us. We take what we need. They take what we need. And we exist in harmony together. It is not about spreading ourselves larger and bigger and taking up more space. It is about respecting what is around us. Mm-hmm. And as Andrea might well know through some of our G-chats this week, I had a real problem with Jim, mm-hmm, in this movie. I had a real fucking problem. And again, I was watching this movie, and I really enjoyed it, and I was so glad I enjoyed it again after already saying we should do an episode on it. But Jim, in this now 2021 viewpoint, just exemplified American exceptionalism. Jim feels that he is owed this trip. He's wanted it since he was 8 years old. He is owed Kelly's belief in Bigfoot because he says, how can you prove there isn't one? To which she says, we can believe different things and still be a couple. Which, holy shit, red flag. He also feels that he is somehow owed her hand in marriage. And in that discussion in the camp and in the tent towards the end of the film, it becomes much clearer how new their relationship is. And, you know, her agreeing to move with him is him kind of saying, okay, well, I'll move to LA with you. It's, mm-hmm, like, all right, calm down, Jim. Get it. You're a decent human being, maybe. And ultimately, the show of him in this film is about him rather than the world as he encounters it. He is full of bad faith arguments, and it's so convoluted and so strange because Kelly is just going with him on this trip. She's going. She's there. She's already fucking there, bro. You don't need to bully her into believing what you believe. It is so sickening to watch. And there is a lack of acknowledgement, a lack of respect for the life around him. And it just feels to me ultimately that he feels that he is owed this right to consume, to own, and to be right. It has this real, like, just asking the question kind of energy. Mm. Like, you know, Andrea and I were talking a bit about this off mic. In 2013, okay, you can believe in Bigfoot. And now in 2021, we have a lot of conspiracy theories that are entering the mainstream, and it's becoming increasingly scary that certainly a percentage of the population believes these things, mm-hmm, and it's really fucking concerning.
Well, to start with, I really appreciate how much attention is paid to their relationship dynamic in this film. I feel like it's set up as your typical found footage vanity project. 100,000 documentaries on Amazon Prime right now where a white guy goes out and to the woods because he wants to be that guy. He wants to be the guy who bucks science and topples the ivory tower and finds Bigfoot. And while I agree that Jim is the personification of a pair of fucking cargo shorts and not an especially likable man, it also makes me think of other conversations we've had off mic where where we talk about how people kind of come to awareness on their own terms and at their own pace. There's give and take in every relationship, and ideally you agree to tolerate your partner's passions even if you don't share them. And I know I've talked on this podcast about how me and my current partner, I was just kind of like, hey, you're going to move into the Rue Morgue Manor, you are going to be the horror guy because I am that horror girl, and that means going to these events and being in my shadow because I have to ignore you and shake hands and be that person. And so as a result, I got into the UFC, which was something that he was interested in. And sometimes I'm genuinely into it, and sometimes I'm just playing along. Sometimes I drag him to horror events, and one day I might have to contend with all the testosterone and nu metal that comes with a live fight. Who knows? The point is, there are levels in engagement when you're not really interested in something. And, like, there's tolerating it and going along with it. And you get the sense that this relationship is very young and that she's kind of like, okay, this means a lot to you. Let's go on a camping trip. Fuck it. I will be a good sport. And I feel like she's being a very good sport throughout. But there's a line between getting into it to be a good sport and then suspending your disbelief. And this is something that I come into a lot when it comes to horror, is there's people who fire up a horror movie and are desperate to solve it. Like, they don't kind of go along with it. They don't suspend their disbelief. And perhaps they don't believe that there is an active suspension of disbelief at stake, but I firmly believe that there is. And so you start to see the tension between them where she's agreed to the trip and she's cheerful, but she's clearly not taking it seriously, and it bugs Jim. And I can kind of understand this feeling of, why'd you come along if you're not even open to believing that it is possibly a thing? And he fires back at her with LA. Like, when LA initially comes up, it's as a retaliation of that. It's like, well, you're not open to the existence of Bigfoot. I'm not open to moving to LA. You have preconceived notions about Bigfoot. I have preconceived notions to LA. And if you're not mentally and emotionally open to something I'm passionate about, then I can be equally stubborn. And insofar as I felt that cringe when I saw that scene of he's being a horse's ass, and this is, you know, big for her. This isn't her Sasquatch hobby. This is her career. This is a big deal. I actually felt like their proposal was kind of sweet. I felt like he actually came around and was just kind of like, look, every relationship is a leap of faith and every experience is a leap of faith. And you're here with me. I'll take that leap of faith to LA with you. And yeah, I was almost scared to admit it to you that I kind of bought it, that suspending one's disbelief is a choice. Opening someone's mind is a conscious choice. And there's a big cognitive gap between I don't believe they exist and I don't know, maybe.
Well, and I think this film does an interesting job of complicating that, because it's made very clear that Kelly is just kind of joining along. She's like, okay, I'll go along with this, as I would.
Same.
If I was with someone.
And I have, and I do.
And I would fucking go to Willow Creek. I would go visit the Bigfoot statue. Sure. But it's when there are people saying to them, don't go in there.
Mm-hmm.
And even to the point where the guy's at the car who say, like, throwing shit at them.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, we should fucking just turn around and go. And he doesn't acknowledge it. They still have to go in. And she's kind of clearly nervous. And, you know, it's just like this weird, fucked up thing of her having this lack of belief and this intuition that something is wrong. And then knowing, as a horror audience member, you know, I'm sitting in the theater at Toronto After Dark, a horror genre festival, knowing this probably isn't going to turn out too fucking well for Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And I
think Kelly.
Or Kelly. And I think that's the framing that this film does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, one of my favorite lines ever in horror from the Blair Witch Project, when the woman at the beginning says, I believe enough not to go in there.
Yeah.
Meaning the woods.
Uh-huh.
I think that is, like, a fantastic line, that I don't truly know, me, Alex, what I believe in, but I believe enough not to go into the dark basement of Rue Morgue anymore.
Mm-hmm. Really?
You guys lured me in there once before. I'm not going back.
You don't think I could lure you down?
No!
Well, now I want to try.
No!
Okay.
Oh, no. I don't want to go down there.
Ultimately, I feel like this relationship dynamic, it's so distracting, like, because you're watching them talk about it and you're kind of, you know, you're forming your alliances. I agree with her here. I agree with him here. This is happening and that is happening. But fundamentally, when the shit hits the fan, they are very much together in it. And I felt like the danger was shared, and you didn't feel that way. You're making
No, I did feel that way. I was literally just yelling at my TV, Kelly, you can do better.
I mean, of course she can, but can't we all in life? Like, people who die in horror movies, couldn't they have all gotten better? Didn't they all deserve better? Especially the chicks.
I just really fucking hate Jim.
I know you hate Jim, but I want to unpack that. I do agree that there is an ego in Jim, that he wants to be the Sam Squanch guy. And I don't know, maybe it has to do with my own personal location where I'm like, hey, Destin, hold the camera while I get this content for Instagram. Yeah, like, am I the Jim in my relationship?
But you're not putting Destin in danger.
I mean, I don't think Jim knew he was putting...
Listen, if someone came to, like, Rumorg Manor a la Poltergeist and
said,
was like, you're all
now.
Doomed,
yeah.
You'd probably be like, oh, I should maybe think about this for 30 seconds. Not like, I've got another fucking way around to get into the campsite.
30 seconds max. But I don't listen to anybody. I follow my gut and I follow my passions and I expect my loved one to follow me into hell. And I may well lead him there. Like, time will
tell. This is true. But I think ultimately there's so much of this narrative that is dependent and evocative of the American exceptional ideal. And I say American, but I also mean North American and I mean Western when I talk about this.
White.
White. Real fucking white.
Yeah.
And I mean that as a white person, pejoratively.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this idea that we can just go into these places and fuck around and find this shit. And it is colonialism. It is pure fucking colonialism. So one of the things this film got me to do was finally watch the documentary Grizzly Man by Werner Herzog.
Oh.
So many exes have tried to be like, oh, watch Grizzly Man. And I was like, all right, I'll get to it. But I was also reading a few things that compared Willow Creek to Grizzly Man. So I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. So I watched it. And it is a really tragic, upsetting documentary about a man who lived among grizzly bears for a number of summers in Alaska. I think it was like 13. And in his 13th summer, a grizzly bear fucking eats him and his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And Werner Herzog puts together all the footage and, you know,
puts it in this grand ideological context that only a Werner Herzog voiceover can do.
And the Werner Herzog voiceover is parodied for a reason, because it's a bit too fucking much. However, I thought there was something also really interesting that evoked what Dickey wrote about in his writing and his interviews, as well as that moment with Sean of the Hoopa tribe from Willow Creek, where Werner Herzog talks to the curator in Kodiak, Alaska, of the Aleutic Museum, and his name is Sven Hawkinson. And he talks about when tourists came to this museum and they, like, ripped off the hand of a stuffed bear and they, like, trampled through this museum, taking things and touching things and destroying things. And they talk to him about the main guy in Grizzly Man. And, you know, Sven is very open and he talks about how it's disrespecting the species of the bear.
Mm-hmm.
It's disrespecting their territory. And this is a place where we don't have rights to go in there mm-hmm. and fuck around. And it's this idea that this guy was going to go in there and just be like, I understand bears and I understand this and this and this about them. There is literally a saying called don't poke the bear for a reason.
Yeah.
All of this, and with watching Troll Hunter, it just reeked to me of this white people going into places, claiming them as their own, wanting to instill themselves in it, claiming it. And we talked a lot about this in our episode on Ravenous.
Mm-hmm.
And these films essentially are warning us, saying, don't fucking do that. Be respectful. Be curious. But in that curiosity, be respectful.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things like we go into territories and we go into places and it's like human beings aren't quite meant to be there. But as we expand into them, we destroy the habitats. We destroy the species. We are an epidemic on this world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard to reconcile
mm-hmm.
because we have been taught this thing that if we go in and we stamp our fucking claim on it, then we are worthy, then we are worthwhile. And what we should be taught, I believe, is that we should exist in harmony. Mm-hmm. And that should be enough.
There's definitely a colonial mindset at stake here. And I love that you brought up Grizzly Man, because I was thinking about that when I was thinking about preparing this episode. I was also thinking about Steve Irwin. And there are so many cautionary tales of we might think that we have mastered the known universe, but we will never know the wild. We should never know the wild. We should never try. And I agree with you that these are all cautionary tales toward the idea of living in harmony with the world at large. But at the same time, the function of films like this is to reify that messaging and be like, hey, you fly too close to the sun, you get burned. And that's what happens to Jim. It's what happens to Kelly, because she goes along with it because she loves him, whether or not you choose to believe that that's a romantic thing or a foolishness thing, whatever. But I think the found footage conceit is I'm bringing this camera along to prove that I was right. And instead, it proves the exact opposite.
But it actually does prove him right. In the end, because Bigfoot is real.
Bigfoot is real, but I don't think he meant to offer himself up on a slab to it. And, you know, the image of the missing woman appearing in her underwear was chilling. And I tried to kind of unpack that. Like, what does this mean for Bigfoot? And then I decided that it doesn't fucking matter. Fundamentally, it's all about the mystery. And at the end of the day, at the end of this episode, it is all about the mystery. If you are interested in Bigfoot, you are interested in it as a mystery. And so trying to prove or disprove it would only kill the mystery.
But that's our very not cheery episode on cryptids.
And in fairness, this subject, there are so many cryptids out there. We didn't talk about the Mothman. I'd love to do a Mothman episode someday. Fucking Chupacabra, the Loch Ness Monster, all these. But I do fundamentally feel like they boil down to a missing link between humanity and nature. And then there's a whole discourse about dinosaurs and creationism. And like, this shit runs deep, and we can go further if you want. But I think these two films, the fact that they're found footage really harkens back to the original Patterson-Gimlin footage, that there was once a time where pictures didn't lie. And I can prove it because I've got footage. And I think the found footage subgenre of horror really draws upon that conceit of we can prove it because here it is. And here are these two films, one of which incorporates a whole bunch of capital CGI, and is still compelling and fun and funny. And the other one, which is a bit more bleak, but still kind of toys with the verite aspect of the format to great effect.
Yeah, and I think both of these films just ultimately bring about, what are we doing in these places that we are not welcome? What is the cost of our souls, let alone our humanity? Mm-hmm. At what cost do we venture into these territories to own it? And there's so much going on in the world, because I feel like as humans, I was not taught about colonialism in my public education.
Never. Nope.
I had to learn about it a little bit through my post-high school education and then on my own as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I thankfully have been able to find people who have been able to really educate me about it and understand my place in Canada as a settler. There's so much to unpack from there, and we are, as a culture, so reticent to do it, to the fact that colonialism is currently happening in Palestine.
Yes.
Recording today, Israeli forces have blown up the Al Jazeera building and the Associated Press building. Mm-hmm. And like, we are fighting for our governments to recognize this as colonialism, as genocide. And it is really fucking scary, the shit I'm seeing on social media and the lives I'm seeing taken. Mm-hmm. Because of perceived ownership of land.
That's right.
It is chilling.
That's right. And we're very critical of conspiracy theories, but the idea of these being colonialism is being framed as a conspiracy theory, and it's not the case.
No, and I think that's kind of the frustrating thing, is you see, you know, these, I'm just asking questions. How can you prove Bigfoot isn't real? And it's like, there are real fucking things happening in this world, and people are suffering, and children are dying, and we are so fucking concerned with Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And we need to recognize our history of colonialism for ourselves as North Americans, and for myself and Andrea, as we constantly reckon with ourselves. And as a global culture, we need to stand up against colonialism. Mm-hmm. when it happens and pay attention and fight with all of our might, even if it's just tweets and everything else that we can do to stop it, because it's not ending. And we will be distracted for the ends of time on the shit that doesn't matter when we should be respecting nature and not watching our fellow humans die.
Yeah, and that's our lighthearted episode.
I thought this was going to be a lighthearted episode. It is fucking not, because the world is not lighthearted right now.
No, that is very true. And I think we are very transparent that, again, these films read different 5 years ago. They will read different 5 years from now. But at current, this is what it made us think of. And, you know, that's what we're here to do. Is The Faculty of Horror a weird time capsule of what a couple of white female feminist academics are talking about on the...
Oh, I don't know, Andrea.
In the middle of 2021. On the cusp of this pandemic where everything is, like, throwing our shit for a loop. Do you ever think about that?
No.
How our content is going to read a year from now, much less 5 years from now?
Well, I feel like that's, for me, just looking, like, in the void, and then the void stares back.
I know, but I feel like I haven't really been concerned about that void until we entered such a crazy fucking time.
Well, so I'll just say, this next episode that we're doing is something I've wanted to do for a really long time.
Well, that's worth something.
Right? So, just to reference our friends in Spinal Tap, you're a naughty one, saucy Jack. We're going to be talking about Jack the Ripper.
Yes.
I'm excited. I was obsessed with Jack the Ripper as a child, which I'll be talking about a whole lot more in the next episode. Now, I wasn't like a fan of him. I was intrigued by the idea that a serial killer was like real and never caught. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be talking about two films that have tackled the Jack the Ripper mythology. That is Alfred Hitchcock's The Lodger and the Hughes Brothers' From Hell. We will also be dealing with the problematic men involved in both of those films.
Yay!
More fun.
I think this is going to be a really interesting episode because we have talked about the phenomenon of true crime, the appeal of true crime, the tremendous white female fandom and adulation of true crime. But Jack the Ripper is the OG true crime story that captured everyone's imagination. There have been countless fictional interpretations of it. We picked these two, but we'll talk about them at length.
There's so much to talk about within this narrative, from the histories to the way these histories are interpreted. So I think we have a lot to get to. I'm sure you will all be hearing my horrible British accent much more in the next episode.
Yay!
It's very exciting for everyone involved.
It's not that bad. I wouldn't want to go up against you in it.
Governor!
See, if you guys could see the right angles at which she is bending her arms, it's very British.
I'm doing a little jig, governor!
Love it.
I'm half British, too.
There you go. So until your other half acknowledges that.
Office hours are thankfully closed.
I still feel.